Greetings to each and all. This is John Lash with Newsflash number 3 from GaiaSpora.org. The date is January 27th, 2015. The title is, The Atrocity of Islam is the Deal Breaker. Before I start the message to go with the written text for this newsflash, I need to inform you all that I recently had a technical event about 10 minutes ago, actually. I want to make it clear that this technical event has nothing to do with sabotage or some anonymous forces messing with my system. I keep the JLL at metahistory.org mail exclusively on a MacBook Pro that I bought in 2010. That particular model of the MacBook Pro has a factory defect, so it is due to the defect of the machine that the machine crashed, and when I rebooted it, there was no mail and not even an account for JLL at metahistory.org. So I have quite a considerable amount of mail in there, some of which I've answered, some of which I haven't answered yet. I don't know how far back I will be able to go in retrieving this mail. So those of you who have written me recently at that address need to write me again. And you need to beware that if you don't hear from me, it's probably because I haven't been able to retrieve your mail. So just wanted to get that technicality out of the way. And now I can launch into the subject of the moment. As I proceed with this recording to accompany the written text for this newsflash, I'm looking at the computer screen with the text I've written that you're going to be reading, that you're going to see when you pull up this URL. And so I'm more or less following the text that I've already written. It's quite an extensive text. And I'm adding my comments and spontaneous remarks on that text as we proceed. As you'll see, the text begins with my advisement. Like that word. Here's my advisement, folks. Okay? I encourage everyone to stick to their continuing education on Islam. So there are some essential clips, some essential things to watch. You may find out, if you have the stomach and the mind for this little undertaking, that it's not really that difficult to get your mind around Islam. In fact, the principles and premises and precepts of Islam are idiotically stupid and not difficult to comprehend. It's not a complex paradigm, although it is an extremely devious paradigm. I advise all of you, and I call upon all of you who know any Muslims, to go to them and sit down face to face and eye to eye and to interrogate them, as suggested here. First question, do the five pillars of Islam come from the Quran? My first encounter with the five pillars of Islam occurred in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in January of 1991. At that time, the United States attacked Iraq due to the fact that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. Remember that event? That's like ancient history now. It's like talking about some battle that occurred in the Middle Ages, isn't it? Well, the fact is, the Gulf War, as it was quaintly called at that time, exploded in January of 1991. And there I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there was quite a movement in the town against the war. The Quakers got involved. The old hippies got involved. Everybody got involved. Even the Jews got involved. I remember there were talks at the Jewish synagogue. of anti-war protesters. Okay? So anyway, at one point, I moved in to this development, which was unusual for me. But I found myself in the presence of people who were launching a massive protest against the Gulf War. And at one point, I remember very clearly, in the clear winter light of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains of Santa Fe in January or February of 1991, I found myself sitting beside an individual who lived in Santa Fe who was a Muslim. Wow, lo and behold. And we were at a table discussing the events of the day, and at some point when there was a break, I said, I don't really know any Muslims. Wonder if you tell me a little bit about your thing, what are the principles, you know, and the guidelines of Islam. And this guy says to me, well, we follow the five pillars of Islam. That's what Muslims do. The five pillars, as they're called, they're five practices. Oh, yeah, okay, well, I said, well, like, for example, what? And he said, well, one of them is that our religion teaches that when someone we know is ill, like a friend or a member of the family, that we should go to the hospital and visit them. Long silence. I swear, I sit there looking at this guy. I had to restrain myself from saying, are you a total fracking idiot with no conscience and no empathy? Are you telling me that your religion commands you to go see a sick friend in the hospital? And that's how you define your faith, by following that command? I didn't say anything of that sort. I didn't want to confront the guy in that situation. It would have been pointless. So I just let it blow by me like a fly that just buzzed by my head. But that was my first encounter with a Muslim. I swear to you, if he was there today, he would not leave that room standing. So, what are the five pillars of Islam? They'll tell you that those are the pillars. Giving charity to the poor, visiting friends in the hospital. They'll tell you that these actions, which any sane human animal possessed of the slightest shred of empathy would automatically do out of their own nature, are divinely dictated commands that they follow, and that's what makes them Muslims, okay? Those who submit to the will and commandments of Allah. Next question is to ask, by the way, the five pillars do not come from the Quran. They're not found in the Quran. Second question to ask them is, well, does observing the five pillars make you a Muslim true to the faith, or is there more required? You know, if you're going to face Islam, and you better start facing it, you need to realize the absurd necessity of taking responsibility for the fact that with merely 2 weeks of study, you are going to know more about what Islam is than most of the 1.4 or 6 billion Muslims in the world. You need to be able to accept the reality of that situation. Finally, you could ask them, well, can you be peaceful and show goodness, which you claim to be, toward the world and toward non-Muslim society without any identification with Islamic beliefs? Why do you need Islamic beliefs in order to walk and move and act in the non-Islamic world as a peace-loving person who treats others with kindness and fairness? Why would you be able to do it without that? And any other question that comes to your mind, I invite you all to seek these confrontations as I myself will seek them. Now, here are three items of essential study regarding this problem. One, the Muslim Agenda full documentary. Two, 20 errors in an ABC special on Islam. And three, an excellent documentary by Tom Holland on the origins of Islam, presenting evidence that it actually originated not in Saudi Arabia, neither in Mecca or Medina, but, get this, in the very area of modern-day Israel, where the Dead Sea cult of the Zadokites arose. Please note that the Tom Holland piece, which I believe is from the BBC, is posted on a Messianic Christian YouTube channel, and the excellent piece on the 20 errors in the ABC special on Islam is presented by an apologetic Christian. So as you know, I've said before, I consider such people to be informants. You know, if I'm going to bust a drug ring, then I want my informant to be someone who is in the drug ring. And I expect my informant to be able to provide me with information that would not come from someone who is outside. Now, as I'm looking through my notes here, I want to point out that I still need to do a follow-up interview with somebody to talk at more length about AI, the archontic infection. Now, I introduced this notion on the Red Ice interview of August 8th this year, or last year, excuse me, which was the anniversary of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. Now, I'd like to include in the notes, I am including in these notes, to go with this audio, a kind of chronological overview of the archontic infection for all of you to take into account and to memorize and to master. This is extremely vital Gnostic intel coming to you today from living telestic sources. All right? It's not coming from anywhere else, is it? Okay. Here goes. Here's the overview chronologically presented. For the purposes of exposition, for the purposes of illustration, and consistent with the mindset of the human mind thinking in historical terms, let's date the stage one neural infection to around 1800 BC. That would be the transition of the vernal point from the bull into the ram, and the beginning of the Aryan Age. 1800 BC or so is traditionally assigned to Abraham, the bibliopatriarch, for what it's worth. The archons achieved the delivery of the mucus that carries the archontic infection in the medium of aphid milk, and they introduced this milk into the ear canal by the delivery system of invisible mites, that is to say, Akari insects, which the archons themselves were able to propagate spontaneously in the biosphere. The mucus carrying the archontic infection spread to the right temporal lobe and entirely hijacked the auditory complex, disguising itself behind the neurotransmitter L-dopa. Consequently, Zadokite Jews of that period began to have a voice-to-skull experience in which they believed that God was talking to them directly in their own minds, in their own heads, in their skulls. One of the characteristics of this phenomenon of takeover of the neural network by the archontic virus is the shaking of the head. And you see this today in the Jews at the Wailing Wall, and in the Jews at the Yeshiva, the young Jews in the schools, reading the Torah, shaking their heads back and forth. The shaking of the head is typical of the presence of the archontic virus. Also, the weird mechanism of the phylacteries, or the box worn on the forehead of Orthodox Jews, is a symbolic representation of the installation of the foreign archontic mindset in the neural network of the human animal. Those who are infected in this manner, namely with the primary or stage one neurological infection, have no internal voice of conscience in their own minds. They, in fact, have the voice of the authorities, the voice of the off-planet authorities of the Lord Archon Yeldabaoth, pretending to be the supreme creator being. Next, we slide down to about, 300 AD, excuse me, 30 AD. At this moment, you see the inception of the stage one infection spreading by proxy. And that is salvationist Christianity introduced by the Apostle Paul. I covered how all this happened in the first six chapters of Not in His Image. Those who convert to this salvationist ideology, which is the expression of the stage one neural infection, do not themselves need to have the neural infection, but they act as if they do. So, traditional Christians insist also on the continuity of the Old and New Testament, and they take the ancient Hebrews as the model of people obedient to God. It all makes perfect sense when you see it in an epidemiological perspective, doesn't it? Jumping ahead to around 650 AD, the timing here is vague. It's going to be somewhere from 650 to 750 AD. The stage two neural infection kicks in. The virus reboots. In evidence of this, you see the rise of Islam, and not too long after that, the rise of the Ashkenazi Judaism in Khazaria and the conversion of the Khazarian people who were Asiatic Turks and Asiatic peoples to Judaism. Very complicated development at this time. I can't fully elucidate all the threads and aspects and fractures and angles and associations and correlations involved, and I don't yet know them myself. Mainly, to be honest with you, I don't know how it rebooted itself. There must have been a physical event through which this happened. I'm thinking it may have been a plague event of some kind, but I can't locate a plague event in that historical epoch. I will tell you this, though, and you can quote me on this. John Lash described for the first time publicly the archontic infection as a neural or neurological hack. Not a genetic hack into the human genome, but a neural hack into the human brain. John Lash described this for the first time publicly in August of the year 2014. And John Lash is certain that even though he cannot explain how that neural infection rebooted itself in the 6th or 7th century, the explanation is due to be discovered. Someone researching these matters, or someone who does not even know that I am the sole source of genuine real-time Gnostic intel on the planet, is bound to discover the event that corresponds to the conditions in which this rebooting occurred. And I say that with confidence, and I say that with huge delight. Needless to say, myself and a good many of you others are going to be extremely delighted when this discovery comes to light in one way or another through the alternative media, or who knows, maybe even in the mainstream media or in some forgotten history book. Someone will find the paragraph describing events that occurred in the 6th and 7th century that account for the neural rebooting of the archontic infection. True mental derangement now begins to run rampant. you'll note that in the documentary The Muslim Agenda at minute 43:40, you get a textual scroll of some of the absolutely insane comments in the hadith of Islam. Now remember what Bill Warner said. Islam, being a true Muslim, means following three things. It does not mean following this idiotic formula of the five practices. That's ridiculous, superficial ploy. A true Muslim follows the Quran, especially in the later abrogated passages of the Medina Quran, which are violent against all kafirs, follows the example of Muhammad, and follows the hadith, which are the commentaries on Muhammad. And you get an idea of what is in these hadith. Well, you can't, I myself, if I looked for it, if I tried to invent it, I couldn't come up with anything more corruptly, insanely ridiculous coming out of the human mind than a good number of these hadith. Under the complete tyranny of Islam, you, as a kafir, would live subject to clerics who pronounce your fate in society, and those clerics would hold these hadith, every single one of them, in unquestionable authority. You'd do better with living under the rule of a band of hell's angels whacked out on angel dust. You'd have better chances of survival. Proceeding again, we come to around 1850. The emancipation of the Jews in Europe occurred around 1849, 1850, due to machinations, I never know how to pronounce that, of the Jesuit order and the Freemasons who were themselves puppets for the Jewish cabal. So, stage two infection neurologically kicks in with Islam, the rise of Islam, and stage two infection by proxy spreads. Note this, my friends. The plot thickens, and as it thickens, the plot sickens. Stage two infection by proxy spreads under the direction of stage one vector group, the Jews, who lead the rise of worldwide communism. And of course, I remind you of a great joke. I remind you of a joke that contains a profound truth. Arthur Koestler was involved with communism and also wrote the book on the Khazars, the 13th tribe, said that during his time in the communist cells, there was a joke going around, and it goes like this. Hey, what's the difference between communism and capitalism? Well, communism is the inhumanity of man against man. And what is capitalism? Well, it's the opposite. You are not an intelligent, responsible human being today if you do not know that communism, as it has arisen historically, is nothing but a ploy of Jewish capitalist bankers to redistribute all the wealth of the middle class and the working classes to them. Period. There is no contradiction between communism and capitalism. There is no dichotomy. There is no opposition. They are two parts of the same insidious formula. So stage two infection by proxy spread through communism. And that communism spread into Maoism. It spread into the murderous genocidal insanity of Pol Pot in Cambodia. It spread into the mind of Che Guevara. And they are all such individuals are acting out by proxy the second stage or stage two neural infection. So the notes explain it. Also, I'd like to point out that if you read into the Gnostic sources, there is a Nag Hammadi Codex. I think it's the Tripartite Tractate, which is the longest of them all, that warns about divisions among the Archons and how they are actually battling against each other all the time. You cannot say that the Archons are united in their assault on humanity. They are divided in their assault on humanity. And the Gnostic warning contains that observation, a most significant observation, I would say. Now, as I follow the notes I made, I see they segue into the excellent documentary by Tom Holland. I've indicated the precise places in the documentary to which my comments apply by M1, meaning minute one, M means minute. So you just have a minute-by-minute commentary here. And for the first commentary, in which Holland says that God sent a prophet and an empire, which is the general interpretation of the rise of Islam, on that remark, I add quite an extensive commentary drawn from Nod in his image and in reference to the formation of the Jewish theocracy. So, God sent a prophet and an empire is a foundational proposition for theocracy, plain and simple. And the theocracy of Islam is a rebooting and reframing of the theocracy of the ancient Hebrews that came to be during the time of Samuel, as the notes explain. When I was writing Not in His Image, I considered it fortuitous that I was able to reference Merce Eliade regarding this event. No less a mind, no less a genius of comparative mythology than Merce Eliade. And Eliade made the observation, which is purely Gnostic when you step back and look at it, that the introduction of theocracy among the ancient Hebrews was an anomaly. And due to the introduction of Jewish theocracy, the insidious and secretive cult of Zadok, the priests of Zadok, that is to say the Zadokite sect, was able to control the religious life of the Hebrew people. And the Zadokites actually infected the religious culture of the Hebrew people and perverted it toward their ends. So, it's a brilliant observation here from Eliade, and I've quoted it at length. Coming now to minute 255 of Holland's documentary, he expresses honestly how stunned he is by the lack of historical evidence of Islam. Well, the second stage neural infection is so corrupted that it does not compute on evidence anymore. It is transhistorical. So reasoning and the proof by evidence are not only lacking in Islam, they are condemned by Islam. Reasoning and proof by evidence must be lacking and must be excluded in order for the authority of Islam to be established. Can you see this? Can you see the glaring deceit of this shining in your eyes, shining in your mind? And so, when you listen to Muslim clerics today and apologists, you'll find that they can never counter a reasonable question with a reasonable answer. They cannot say yes or no. For example, to the question, does Islam punish apostasy by death? The question, The answer in the brain infected in both lobes, because that's the stage 2 neural infection, is yes and no. So as Bill Warner emphasizes, the answer to the question, Islam a religion of peace or does it demand death to infidels? The answer is yes to both parts. That is the mindset of Islam. Now, minute 9.16, I comment, 9 minutes and 16 seconds, I comment on Nasser. I happen to have read some of his books over the years and found him to give me the absolute creeps. So I call him a shifty shithouse weasel. He doesn't believe in history. He doesn't believe in reasoning. He's got a superior moral ground. And what is a superior moral ground to an Islamic scholar of his stature? Quote, "Well, not being able to know something is no proof that it does not exist," end quote. Can you detect the complete mind fuck effect of that comment, of that proposition? Nasser makes that proposition because he presumes himself to be in a position superior to any criticism. The Bedouin, minute 6, the Bedouin, disgusting. It should be minute 10, maybe. It's not in sequence. Minute 12, Holland says a whole new civilization was created. Absolutely fracking not. Oh, Nasser claims that, excuse me. Absolutely fracking not. Nasser, your claim for the Arab-Islamic achievement of civilization is totally fracking bogus. A fading civilization was occupied. You know, Islam has never created a new civilization. No more than termites have built a house. Have termites built a lovely log cabin in the forest? I don't think so. And neither has Islam ever created a civilization. Okay, got that straight? Note at minute 12 and 40 seconds, the gesture of the praying Bedouin holding his hands to his ears for acoustic definition as he prays to the off-planet archontic overlord suggests the presence of AI in both temporal lobes, right and left. The man praying is in total voice-to-skull capture and is incapable of human ideation, even regarding the simplest of matters. Are you getting the idea of how terrifying this is? All right. Continuing. I think Holland's treatment is sober and exemplary. At minute 13, 30 seconds, he says, it was this message that gave them an empire. Oh, was it? Well, he shows clearly that the empire happened first, and then the message of Islam was attached to it. Well, exactly the same thing happened with the Holy Roman Empire. The empire existed first with Constantine, and then the salvationist message was attached to it to legitimize it. It's a simple ploy. If the state wants an authority that cannot be questioned, then it must attach to itself a superhuman spiritual authority, so-called, in order to give it the power that it cannot otherwise have. Minute 20 and 20 seconds, the man who buried his daughter alive. Oh, what a lovely story. It contains the detail of the little child brushing sand from his beard. Oh, how tender is that? Oh, how touching. And does it make you forget what he's doing? The gesture of tenderness is invoked here to describe an atrocity. Islam is an atrocity. It's an atrocity you need to face. And you'll be happier and more sane and confident in your humanity by doing so. Child brides, like that girl in that story, are routinely murdered today. Women who do not follow the theocratic patriarchal rule of Islam have acid thrown in their face every day in Pakistan. You going to live with that? You going to let that pass, even if you don't live in Pakistan? The atrocity of Islam is the deal breaker. It tells whether you are willing to take responsibility to uphold humanity or not. Continuing, minute 28. Oh, yeah. Those first Islamic Arabs, who weren't even Islamic by definition, set their eyes on the promised land. That is the land about the Dead Sea, the lowest body of water on earth. That is the land a stone's throw from Qumran, a stone's throw from the Grove of Mamre, where Melchizedek gave Abraham the mission of the chosen people. Can you see how those Arabic Semites, infected with the stage 2 neural hack, the vector species for the stage 2 neural hack, flocked to the exact source of the stage 1 neural hack? Does that make sense? Do you see the picture? Do you see history and the critical events of history which continue to reverberate in horrific consequences across this planet? Do you see it? Do you see it illustrated here? Do you see it illustrated in the simple facts of the case? Those afflicted with the second stage infection return to the place of its origin. The birthright of emergent Islamic Arabs is the same as that of the first stage infection, and the birthplace is the same. That hideous shithole called Israel. And so we go on. Note that Holland says, minute 34, second 50, the Quran dictated, the angel dictating the Quran tells Muhammad to follow the path tread by Abraham. Does it make sense now? So, as the documentary continues, we come to the mysterious object of the Kaaba, which is a huge black stone, central to the foundation myth of Islam. Of course, it is a pure fiction. It was never known to Abraham. It's a retrofitted story. I reckon that Tom Holland's documentary is really strong on this point. He shows excellent reasoning power and respect for the freedom of self-determination in your own mind. He doesn't shove his conclusion down your throat, does he? No. Not like Nasser, who has already made a conclusion that condemns you to be executed because you are never going to have the chance to even agree or disagree with it. No. Tom Holland leaves it in the form of a question hanging in the air. But the Islamic professor, Nasser, speaks for the archontic mind and from the archontic mind. To him, reason is not the ultimate decider of truth. For him, faith in the unseen defines truth and defies truth by reason. And so it cannot be refuted. Simple enough. And so we continue with Holland's documentary. My last point that I make at the end, two last points are, minute 58, second 50, quote, "At last, something we can recognize unmistakably as a new religion," unquote. Really? Well, what's new about it? There's nothing new about Islam. It is merely theocracy reframed from the Jewish theocracy, which in itself was an anomaly to the Jewish mind, which in itself was the ideological vehicle for the neural hack of the archons. Finally, he notes that he uses the word Shekinah, which is cognate with the Hindu and Sanskrit word Shakti, which is cognate with the Greek and even Germanic root, I believe. No, the Germanic root is different. With the Greek root Sak for sacred, the Shekinah is the female aspect of divinity, the Aeon Sophia, that was repressed and excised from Judaic, Christian, and Islamic religions alike. They all have that in common. If you want to know how they all stand together, there you have it. They exclude, defy the goddess, and they want to slaughter and kill anyone who takes her side. Simple enough. Finally, the esteemed Islamic scholar Nasser has to get his two cents in, his resentment. So he says that Westerners can't give Muslims a dose of corrective medicine. Oh, yeah? Well, the problem for Islam is that few people who call themselves Muslims know the principles they are following, and the responsibility falls to infidels, the kafirs, like us, to set them straight. That is a problem for Nasser because it truly signals the end of Islam. You know, this belief system appears to be a lot more powerful than it is, but in fact, it cannot stand up to the most elementary confrontation. Do you wonder why they get so upset? Do you wonder why they get so easily offended? Why they like to be offended? It's quite simple. Because it's so easy to call them on their game. Okay, so that's the Tom Holland documentary. Now I come to the point in my text where I've written, well, this term deal breaker. You know what a deal breaker is. I'll tell you what a deal breaker is for you, sweet human creature, hearing my words. You want to call yourself human? You want to consider that you're a human being? I won't even ask you to consider that you're a human animal. You want to consider that you're a human being? Well, on what terms? On what terms do you place that self-definition? Huh? Does it require anything of you? Well, I submit to you that it does. A true human being is someone who upholds humanity. And tell me, really, just exactly how you're going to do that? You're going to do that by some sentimental idea of yourself? By some narcissistic glorification of your sense of love? No. That's not how you're going to do it. You're going to do it according to the test of this experiment. The Anne Sophia designed this experiment to test the anthropine species. Why else would it be interesting? Why else would you put an animal in an environment if you weren't going to test it? For example, suppose that you released horses into the wilds of Colorado to see if you could get a powerful and resilient breed of Mustang. Well, you would observe how the horse designed to become a powerful Mustang faces and masters the conditions of its environment. Now, it's true, and this is a great, great thing I'm going to say right now, because it shows you how deeply I live in the immediacy of the Gnostic question. Just watch, just listen. When you stay in the story, like I'm doing right now, you know that she did not anticipate that humanity would face the Archons, did she? She herself, the Aeon Sophia, introduced the Archons into this experiment by her mistake, by her anomaly, the plunge from the pleuromic core. So goes the story. How does it happen then that an unprecedented event tests the human creature to uphold humanity, to uphold its humanness? And could it be that this unprecedented test is greater than human capacity because it was not anticipated when Sophia designed the genome with Thelite in the first place. Those are dicey questions. But the answer is simple. Don't get lost in speculation. The answer is really, really simple. The answer comes in two parts, and both of those parts, fortunately, have textual grounding in the surviving materials. In the first place, Sophia and Thelite designed the human genome. They designed the anthropos to respond fully and deeply to the dreaming power of the aeons. They designed us to be interactive with the aeons in the Pleroma. And they ensured the integrity of our talents by the protection of the genome. So the mythological material explains that although the Archons wished to cast their seed into Eve, they could not do so. They were unsuccessful. They could not hack the human genome. It was not a genetic alteration that the Archons achieved. It was a neural hack. And even though the neural hack was unanticipated, due to the fact that we are genomically designed to be invulnerable to any alien influence, you can infer that we are capable of resisting the unprecedented and unanticipated archontic assault. First part of the answer. Second part is even better. You see, we're in this experiment to learn what it means to be human. And to do so is not a mysterious challenge. It's not a mysterious process. How do you learn to be human? By confronting the inhumanity in other human animals. Then you decide. And so, in purely existential terms, it doesn't matter that the archontic assault through the Tzaddikim and through the Islamic version of the same infection were never anticipated. It doesn't matter because, existentially speaking, every threat to your humanity is the same as long as it is a clear and present danger. Anything that threatens your humanity as a clear and present danger challenges you to uphold humanity. You don't have to ponder about it. You don't have to speculate at all. All you have to do is take responsibility for that very act of upholding. The challenge of Islam, the atrocity of what it actually is a clear and present one. Facing it is one way to fulfill the human role in her correction. Now, as you'll see in the written notes that go along with this audio, I wind up this newsflash with a reference to the subject of offense or defamation. You really have to ask yourself this question. Whatever your age is, you know, I'm pushing 70, you know. You may be up there with me. You may be in your early 60s, your 50s, your 40s, your 30s, your 20s. But those of you who are more toward my end of the age spectrum, might well ask yourself this question. Wait, stop the bus. Stop the cameras rolling here. Hold on a second. When did it come to pass that the word was going around the planet that nobody is supposed to offend Muslims? When did this notion become current, and how did it become current? Well, I assure you, my friends, that that notion falls under the definition or the category that you may recall from the GNA. That's the category of Mephisto rules. You know, Mephisto rules means what? First of all, it means Mephisto rules. Mephisto is running the game. It's a warning. Mephisto rules means watch out. There is trickery going on. There is fraud. You are being tricked. You are being duped. Mephisto rules. But it also means that Mephisto rules are in effect. And what is the nature of Mephisto rules? Quite simply, you never know the origin or the premise of those rules. They just seem to pop out of thin air. So there's a rule, isn't there? There's a rule going around the planet. Oh, no one must ever offend Muslims. We must not offend Muslims. Well, what's the origin of this rule? Who laid down this rule? You're never going to find out. Don't bother to go look. It is not worth going down one single rabbit hole to answer that question. Don't waste your time. If you understand what Mephisto rules means, then you'll save yourself the time of trying to investigate it. Because the trickery exists only to waste your time and waste your mind. So you become like me, an existentialist. What is that? According to Sartre's advisement, it means that in every act and thought you conduct yourself, in every act and thought, conduct yourself as if all of humanity had its eyes and mind upon you and were guiding itself by what you do. That's what it means to be a bodhisattva. And all the rest of it is crap. Okay? There's a Mephisto rule that even went to the fucking heights of the UN. The fracking UN. Okay? I don't say fucking because I like fucking. The fracking UN. Fucking is sacred. Fracking is a violation of the earth. The Executive Council of the UN has passed a resolution which is informal, and they want to make it into a formal resolution, and it says what? No one on this planet is allowed to defame the teachings of Islam or the Prophet or to say anything that offends Muslims. That's the rule. You have to sit back on your ass, lean back against the wall, lean back in a comfortable armchair at a 45 degree angle and ask yourself how the frack such a rule could be introduced into human society and now due to be enforced by the UN. What is this about offending the religious feelings of Muslims? You can offend the religious feelings of Jews, can offend the religious feelings of Native American Indians, of Zoroastrians, of Australian Aborigines, of Christians. But wait, Mephisto rules in effect. You cannot offend the religious feelings and convictions of Muslims. Well, I say, and I declare, across the land, And I declare on this crystal clear January day, as I stand in the presence of the almond blossoms in the Serenia Deronda Mountains, that you shall indeed offend the religious feelings and beliefs of Muslims. Offend Islam in any and every way that you can. Because if you do not do so, then by the default of not doing so, you follow the rule by which you betray your own humanity. Is that clear enough? So I'm coming now to my concluding remarks for this newsletter. And I'm happy to bring it around to some positive notes at the end. But before I get to the very end, I want to make one point I consider to be extremely crucial. If we are living on this planet under Mephisto rules that dictate and demand that no one say anything that would offend Muslims or defame their religion, then I ask you this: is there still a grain of sanity left in the human animal that would compel the human animal to ask a simple and logical question, which goes like this? Well, what is so terrible about defaming Islam? What is so terrible? Why are the consequences? What are the consequences that might come to pass by that act of defamation, which must absolutely be avoided by forbidding that act of defamation? Defamation, blasphemy, sacrilege. Well, it must have consequences that are awesomely terrible for the entire human race if this interdiction is to be valid. By not defaming Islam, by not blaspheming the Prophet and the principles of Islam, we would then be avoiding something terrible. What? What is there to be avoided? What is the consequence that would inevitably ensue were the Mephisto rules not to be applied? If you were to act as a free animal who accepts no one's interdiction and no one's rule on your expression, what would be the terrible consequences of that action in the case of defamation and blasphemy of Islam? Well, I'll tell you what the terrible consequence would be. It would be the complete destruction of Islam. It would be the complete destruction of the archontic tyranny, which is not a real tyranny, which is not a real tyranny that can be enforced by reality, but is the illusion of authority that destroys the human mind. The consequence of offending Islam is to defy the illusion of authority that would destroy the human mind. That is the essence of what I am saying. And I invite you to realize the essence of what I am saying as something that is actionable and must be enacted. So on that note, I'd like to bring this audio portion of this news flash to a conclusion and shift into the positive vein. First of all, I want to remind you that this experiment is designed so that the fate of the kalpa turns on one life at a time. In quantitative terms, it makes no sense whatsoever that one human animal could stand against 1.4 billion or 1.6 billion human animals and defeat them. That defies reason. The odds are just too low. But I've often said that the gods like low odds. Haven't I said that? And the lower the light, the better, and the more low they are, the more they like them. And it is a truth to be demonstrated, realized, proven, and celebrated that the outcome of this entire experiment turns on one life at a time. Bear that in mind. Now, I have two positive points to offer you regarding how the experiment on this planet is shifting to the advantage of truth and to the best outcome for all human animals who still have a grain of humanity in them. The first is a kind of a speculative statement that I'll make. I'm just feeling particularly optimistic right now. And I'll tell you what I think and what I see coming. You know, here I am at the end of a number of years expounding through the spoken word on the message of Gnosticism. And it could be said that the teachings of the Gnostics are pretty esoteric, pretty obscure, maybe difficult for many people to grasp. It could be said that the Sophianic message, Sophianic vision of life, has not yet reached the mainstream, may never reach it, because the standard of intelligence required to grasp it is pretty high. But let me tell you what I see now in correction. I see the Charlie Hebdo massacre, whether it was a false flag or even a Sandy Hook-like hoax. I'll get to talking about that soon. Nevertheless, had the effect of galvanizing the attention of the whole world toward the question of what is Islam and how do Muslims behave when they follow Islam to the letter of the faith. And consequently, there is a great deal of human attention on the topic of Islam. And it's very possible, considering the way things work on the internet, that some of that attention, as it persists, as it holds up, might lead through a series of associations to what one particular individual is saying about Islam, namely that it is the stage 2 neural infection of an off-planet virus. Now, that proposition about the off-planet virus, the archontic infection, is, of course, purely Gnostic. You know that, right? And things that are purely Gnostic, the findings of telestic shamanism, the instructions of the telestae, don't generally reach the ears of the public at large, do they? But I submit to you that it's quite possible and may even be probable that due to the massive inquisitory interests now directed toward Islam, some of that interest may come to the Gnostic message about Islam, which is the Gnostic message about the Archons. And so it may well be, in the process of correction, that people will come to the Gnostic intel, and particularly to the epidemiological profile that I've presented, from a very long and external route. And when they come to it, in whatever numbers they come, they may find that it is the core answer that they were looking for in the first place, although they didn't know how to ask the question. Consider that and hold that thought with me. Now, to finally conclude, I'll refer you to something that I said in the GNE about correction before we were in correction. I said that the great lie that is misguiding humanity and leading it to ruin is focused on the Holocaust narrative. That is the main seam of the lie, like the main seam of a dam. And recall that I said that if the Holocaust lie breaks, then the dam comes down and everything behind it pours over the broken dam. Is there any indication that the Holocaust lie is going to break now in correction? Well, I refer you to the link to the statement by Ursula Haverbeck concerning her intention to go public in Germany with the very great fact that there is no place where the murder of 6 million Jews in gas chambers could have happened. And as she says, with simple and yet lucid childlike reasoning, if there is no place where a crime could have occurred, then no crime occurred. So Ursula Haverbeck is playing for what I consider to be, in one sense, my highest desire, and that is the vindication of the German people, the overthrow of the Holocaust lie, and the total reparation, including monetary and financial reparation, for all those generations before us and for those still living today who have been the target of a massive fraud and extortion racket based on that lie.